Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's Home Program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. We are joined here by Dave Zirin once again, host of Edge of Sports, sports editor for The Nation magazine. His latest book is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the sports World Upside Down. Also the author of the NAACP Image Award nominated, the John Carlos story, which we talked about here on the air together, and Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Game We Love, and the People's History of the United States and more. People's History of Sports in the United States and more. And Ali Danois is with us. Ali Danois has been joining the show many times before. He is a contributor to Sporting News, the senior editor of Bounce Magazine, freelance sports and entertainment writer whose work has been published by the Baltimore Sun, L.A. Times, Associated Press, and the New York Times, among others. And Ali and Dave, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
So here we have all this, at least coming out of Baltimore. They've seen all the stories about Flacco getting this huge contract and how the Ravens have now lost to Paul Kruger to the Browns, and Anquan Boldin is off to being traded. And it just, so people are arguing, do they know what they're doing? Isaac Newsom's crazy. And obviously people say, no, he understands what he's doing. But it seems to me the real underlying issue here is not that, Dave Zirin, but has to do with money and sports, has to do with some of the books you've written before.
Well, sure. I mean, money is certainly a big part of this. So one of the things that the NFL does that no other major U.S. sports league does is true revenue sharing. And that is at times a real positive. That means they put all the money in a pot and then divide it by 32. That's why the former Browns and Ravens owner Art Modell, back when there were only 28 teams, he described NFL owners as 28 capitalists who act like socialists. And I always prefer to think of it as, when it comes to NFL owners, they believe in socialism for them and capitalism for us. Because it's not like ticket prices are going down or anything. It's not like because they're choosing not to pay Anquan Boldin, the Ravens, I mean Anquan Boldin or Paul Kruger or possibly even the great Ed Reed, it doesn't mean that it's going to cost any less to go to a game. If anything, the tickets will go up since they just won the Super Bowl. But this is part of what it means, though, to play or to root for and to work in a league that really does strive for financial competitive balance in a way that the other sports do not.
And I just I had a little note here from somebody. I just wanted to let you know that the Paul Kruger announcement I made just came over the wire about 5-6 minutes ago that he's been traded to the Browns. So he's going to the Browns as a free agent. So he's gone. So it's a $41 million contract that he received. Ali?
Yeah, I love that that quote that Dave said, you know, that's attributed to Art Modell when he said, you know, we're a bunch of fat cat Republicans who vote socialist on football. And he makes an excellent point, you know, that the underlying source of the NFL's economic strength is its, you know, survivalist mentality and its egalitarian nature that can go back to the great NFL and AFL war back, you know, in the early 1960s. This is the time of year where people really are up in arms and they're screaming about Anquan Boldin leaving, and they're starting to take a look at the economics here. But I think it's a fascinating case study when you look at the NFL and how they've managed to ascend to this position as the most powerful sports league of all of the sports leagues in America, and some of the things that go into that, from the revolution in the media to the stadium construction media to the way that the NFL operates its monopolistic cartel. And the various revenue streams that they bring about. And this is just something that folks who don't really kind of grasp the economic nature of what this thing is all about, they'll yell and scream and wonder why Anquan Boldin didn't get paid. But there's a structure in place that allows this thing to hum along unimpeded. And when the football kicks off again next season, you know, folks will sit down. They'll pay that $10 for a beer. They'll buy that seat, and it'll be business as usual.
And, Mark, can I jump in
on that?
Please,
Dave, go ahead, man.
And I think one of the things, too, that this shows is that the NFL has a staying power despite this revolving door of players from team to team to team. And the reason for that is very conscious, and it has more to do with injuries than it does with free agency. But the NFL has always been extremely savvy about selling the name on the front of the jersey, not the name on the back of the jersey, and getting people to root for teams and not individual players. And you do have exceptions, of course, like when a Ray Lewis comes along, but Ray Lewis is a once-in-a-generation player. Ed Reed is a once-in-a-generation player. For most casual fans, it's about the name on the front, not the name on the back, because in a league where any play can be your last, the league doesn't want our marketing synapses in our brains to be connected to individual players. And I just had this experience, this is what makes me think about it, where I was talking to this class of people who wanted to be sports journalists at the University of Maryland, about 25 people, and I asked them, like, if there was a player you could meet, an active player, who would it be? And the overwhelming majority said NBA players. When I asked them what their favorite sport to watch was, it was football.
Uh-huh.
It just says so much. Like, the NBA markets individual players while the NFL markets teams.
But how is the economic dynamic that different between basketball and football, Dave?
Oh, it's the main thing that's profoundly different about it is the issue of revenue sharing. Like, the Lakers make in a year in TV money what it takes the Portland Trailblazers 11 years to make. And so even though they're with the latest collective bargaining agreement, there are more restrictions about how much you can spend if you are a deep-pocketed NBA owner. There are still, as you can see from some of the latest contracts, there are still certainly loopholes to pay people what you want if you want them on your roster.
I guess the connection I'm trying to make here, I was thinking about, and maybe I'm stretching it, making a stretch, but maybe I'm not, I don't know. But when I look at what happened now with the trades going on in the NFL, what happens with the strike that almost happened with the NBA, what happened in hockey. But then I also look at what you've been talking about, Dave, in terms of Venezuela and baseball, which I want you to talk about in a few minutes because I think it's fascinating and fits into this, and the Olympics getting rid of wrestling. To me, it all kind of talks about where sports have gone completely, which is the bottom line of profit and the profit in the pockets of the owners and the profits that come out of advertising that go into those teams. Am I stretching it too far?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking Dave. No, both of you. Go start with Dave, then we'll go to Ali.
Just say quickly that, I mean, there's a degree to which that sports has always been that way. I say it's always been about business. The main thing that I think has changed is how owners determine their bottom line has changed dramatically in the last 20, 30 years from being a situation where they needed to make sure they had butts in the seats. They needed to make sure that fans were showing up and going through the turnstiles. Today, they want our tax dollars. They want sweetheart cable deals, in other words, television money, and they want luxury box money. And that means the sports themselves aren't catered to working-class fans, and they're certainly not catered to sports fans who live in the global south. And the people I just mentioned, people who live in the global south and working-class fans, those are the people who consume Olympic wrestling. So they weren't exactly given much of a voice in that decision.
Ali?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about amateurism and the Olympics, and we talk about this phenomenal growth that we've seen in the sports industry, I think if we just take a look at something simple like the television revenue and what that means and what that portends for the discussion that we're having, we start to see this huge escalation in terms of sports kind of taking on a different meaning, not only in business but in society in general. When you go back to the merger of the warring football leagues back in the late 60s, early 70s, the affiliations of the TV networks and, you know, how that thing kind of progressed to where in 1993, the Fox network kind of crashed the TV rights auction. And CBS had this sweetheart deal with what they were airing for the NFL for $290 million. Fox came in and outbid them I think it was about a $395 million offer. And the shockwaves of that, we've continued to see reverberate. And so, you know, the points that Dave makes are very valid. You know, we can see a shift from this blue-collar fan base and mentality of teams and leagues kind of catering to that fan base to now we look at all of these different elements that comprise revenue streams. And, you know, we have corporations now that are working hand-in-hand with teams buying and, you know, just the buying the ad revenue on Super Bowl commercials. And when you look at the sheer amount of money that we're talking about that's being shared and floated around, it really is something that's immense and you know, kind of overshadows some gross domestic product of some pretty reasonable countries.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. We're joined by Ali Danois and Dave Zirin as we look at money and sports and the politics of all that. Your thoughts on that as we see what happens here in Baltimore, which is where we're broadcasting from with the Ravens, and more. 410-319-8888. Dave, let's take a bit of a detour. I really want to lay out something that our listeners may have not heard. They may have heard you in Indiana or some other places talking about it, but the death of Chavez and the role of baseball, in Venezuela and Dominican Republic. And the stories between the two. This is something I'd love you to share so we can talk about it for a minute.
Well, this is deeply connected to the discussion we're having. Because why are the numbers of African-American baseball players, why have they plummeted over the last generation from roughly a quarter of all Major League Baseball players are African-American to under 8% players are African-American? Why is that? Well, the number one reason, on top of all other reasons, is that Major League Baseball made the decision to invest billions of dollars in the Dominican Republic and in Venezuela to build these baseball academies. Now, calling them academies is a bit generous because they're, we're talking like they stack the kids in like firewood. Multiple children share one bathroom. They sign them as young as 15 years old for $3,000. 97% of them never see a minor league contract, and they tend to be disposed of when they're about 18. They're just shown the door, and then that's it for them. So it's a very sad, highly exploitative state of affairs. Now, when Chavez took office, the 22 of the 30 major league teams had academies in Venezuela. It's always been a rich source for major league baseball talent. Think Miguel Cabrera, the Triple Crown winner for the Tigers, is one example. Pablo Sandoval, the King, Felix Hernandez, all born in Venezuela. But Hugo Chavez, one of the things that he did was he made demands of Major League Baseball, saying that the exploitative relationship between MLB and Venezuela is going to end. So wherever the academy is, I mean, first of all, we're going to tax it. We're going to tax the bonuses that you give players. And we're also going to make sure that you provide jobs for any locals in whatever countryside hamlet your academy is set up in. Now, as you might imagine, this went over, this did not go over well. It went over about as well as, Dick Cheney at a vegetarian convention. You know, it wasn't good. People did not respond well to this. So Major League Baseball, they pulled out. And today, amazingly, there are only five baseball academies left in Venezuela out of 30 Major League Baseball teams. But they haven't stopped recruiting Venezuelan players. What they've done instead is it's even worse, is they sign them in Venezuela and then whisk them off hundreds of miles from their families and just put them in one of the academies in the Dominican Republic. But the whole point is to say that Major League owners breathed quite a sigh of relief when Chavez passed away.
Didn't I hear you say or write somewhere that yes, that during the international the baseball tournament in Japan they wouldn't lower the flag to half mast? Did you say that?
Well, no, it's. I mean, it was the World Baseball Classic game that was actually being played in Venezuela was one of the teams, and the Venezuelan government made a formal request to Major League Baseball to fly the flag at half mast, and this was the day Chavez died, and they said no.
You know what's interesting, and you know I might just shift gears a little bit, but there's a similar parallel to if you look at when we're talking sports. sports and business and the exploitative nature of the way some of these organizations run their business and farm out the talent. We're looking now at the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit that's going on in the NCAA, and this is going to have some major ramifications for possibly, you know, the future of what the NCAA looks like. You know, Ed O'Bannon was watching some friends' kids play a video game, and he noticed that they were playing with his national championship UCLA squad, and there was a player on there that, you know, had his likeness and his uniform number, and he said, well, you know, I never gave the NCAA my permission to use my image and my likeness, and, you know, I think guys like me, you know, should see some of this revenue from it. It's a really simplified way to kind of lay the discussion out, but, you know, a long story short, this is a major affront to what the NCAA is going to have to deal with in terms of compensating generations of college athletes who we all know are exploited on the college campus, and, you know, the revenue that they generate from the ticket sales and from the apparel, the NCAA money they bring in when they go to the tournament pales in comparison to the cost of a scholarship. And, you know, there are guys that say, hey, I can't afford a price of pizza, but I can see my jersey hanging in the bookstore selling for $80. So, you know, this is going to be something that we really should be paying attention to, especially now that folks like Oscar Robertson and Bill Russell are standing in the class to challenge the NCAA on its own antitrust grounds.
Now, that's one of your favorite subjects, Dave, the NCAA.
Well, it's so funny. I was talking with somebody today, and they asked me, like, how I can still love sports knowing how much exploitation there is in sports and write about the exploitation in sports and the greed and the oppression and yet still loving sports. And I said, well, I do still love sports except for the NCAA. Like, that's just, it's a step too, it's gotten to that point for me where I can't watch it, because it's one thing to know that someone is engaged in what is a dangerous labor, like playing a contact sport, and they get hurt playing that sport, and knowing in the back of my head, okay, well, there's a doctor there, there's a trainer there, there's some sort of workers' compensation there, something in their contract there. And then there's the NCAA, where the very term student athlete actually arises out of a lawsuit where the NCAA was defending themselves from having to pay workers' comp to a crippled player. And they were saying, well, no, we don't owe them workers' comp, because they're student athletes. They're not workers. That's the origin of the phrase. And so there's something about that where it's like it's a bridge too far. Like, wow, they're just wheeling these kids out there with the hope, with the dream, with the idea that perhaps they might find their way into a professional locker room while not giving them anything close to a legitimate education and not even giving them the full rights of a human being to stand up and be heard, lest they be cut and thrown on the side.
I wonder what is from both your perspectives, a we've been talking about. I mean, you know, we can analyze, we can see it. We cover these issues a lot on this program. You know, and the NCAA, many people in the country are screaming for its end, that it's outlived its usefulness. It's time for it to go. The only thing it serves is itself. So what's the consequence of this? What is something that can happen from the ground that could affect any of this?
You know, interestingly enough, there are starting to be some discussions about some of the super powerful conferences and universities breaking away from the NCAA and starting their own separate business models. And it's just, you know, kind of going on behind closed doors, and we haven't really heard much about it. But there are some pretty powerful folks in college athletics now who are championing a system where these folks are able to access some income based on the revenue that they're generating for the university. And we're talking about some of those sports like, you know, football and basketball that are major revenue producers. And, you know, there are some sticky things that will probably need to be worked out because some folks on the swimming team and the baseball team might not be too happy. But we are going to see, I think, within the next 20 to 25 years or so, an entirely different business model based on the fact that The time has come for people to really understand the exploitative nature of the NCAA and the imbalance of the benefits that go on there. So, you know, in terms of what specifically, I really don't know what that's going to look like, Mark, but I think we're seeing the tide turn now for a system that's going to be set up that's going to be a little bit more egalitarian in terms of sharing what should have been shared a long time ago with these athletes and are building libraries, who are paying bonuses to the physics department, who are building these great buildings on campus based on their labor. And I think at some point we're going to have a maverick group of schools that's going to make a decision that's going to set things in an entirely different direction.
Dave, you want to jump on that? Jump in on that?
Well, I mean, I will say that, I mean, it's like nature abhors a vacuum, so does injustice. It's the current state of affairs just can't go on as it currently is. It just can't. And you want to talk about workers flexing economic muscle. Imagine what would happen if before the Final Four, the three best players on each team, 12 players, all said they weren't going to take the court unless some of the money got divvied up a little bit nicer. I mean, you would see all of the, you know, these kinds of like, oh, give me the vapors. I'm Scarlett O'Hara on my painting couch. We can't pay these players. All of that would go away faster than you could say plantation. And they would talk immediately to these players about how to get the money into their hands in a way that makes sense. Because, you know, 90% of the NCAA's operating budget comes from the Final Four tournament alone.
Wow.
90%.
Wow.
I mean, that is their lifeblood. And so it would be a fascinating set of occurrences if that took place. It was something that players in the past have actually tried to organize. But it's very hard, especially when you have no real social power. Like, and a coach can dismiss you without cause at any time, and your scholarships are only guaranteed year to year.
That's right. And, you know, we talk about this NCAA tournament, and, you know, March Madness is upon us now. When we look at some of those numbers, just to give some perspective to what Dave is, you know, acutely pointing out, if you look at the amount of money that the Big East Conference made for playing in 109 tournament games over the last 5 years, Mark, we're talking about $26 million, over $26 million that the conference alone has earned over the past 5 years by playing in 109 NCAA tournament games. We haven't even touched on, you know, the $2.5 billion, which is the conservative estimate of how much is going to be bet legally and illegally on this tournament, or the $10.8 billion that CBS and Turner Broadcasting agreed to pay for the next 14 years of TV rights. So we ain't talking about a mom-and-pop operation here.
Just for our listeners, it came over the transom about 15 minutes ago or so that the Ravens have lost another player, that Darnell Ellerby is leaving the Ravens, and it looks like he's reached an agreement with the Miami Dolphins for a multi-year contract, and is also gone, the linebacker. So,
well, you know, they have a saying, Mark, that the pretty girl always gets kissed, right? So, you know, the Ravens, by their wonderful accomplishment, you know, it's great that they were able to bring this great championship to the city, but on the other hand, we're going to see a carcass that needs to be reassembled after all the buzzards have picked it clean.
Yeah, the best thing the Ravens will have going for the next year is I expect their division to be absolutely god-awful.
Right.
I mean, the Steelers are in a lot of ways even more old and decrepit than the Ravens are. The Browns are the Browns. And the Bengals had a good year last year, but they've never had two consecutive good years in all the times that Marvin Lewis has been coach. So that's the best thing they have going for them. But, I mean, I can tell you, I'm really – that Ellerby news, I'm really disappointed. I mean, I thought Ray Lewis retiring,
right,
Anquan Boldin leaving, they'd be able to keep at least the young guys, even if we were losing some of the big names. But I guess we're just losing everybody.
Anybody jumps off before the 7 o'clock hour. Dave Zirin, host of Edge of Sports, Nation Sports Editor, and Ali Denois, Senior Editor of Bounce Magazine. Thank you both so much again for taking time with our show. Always great to talk to both of you, and we'll talk soon.
Always a pleasure.
Take care, y'all. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, the legendary folk singer Tom Paxton joins us. Don't go away.